Peter B. Collins. News and comment for Tuesday, January 17th, 2012. Have you got a secret? Well, since 9/11, the secrecy that our government shrouds its operations in has increased, sometimes to comical and obscene degrees. And my friend and a great investigative reporter, Jason Leopold at truthout.org, is breaking a story here on the 17th of January that when you make a request of the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act, they play a lot of games with you. If you don't ask for exactly the right file, use exactly the right terminology, they'll just say, oh no, we couldn't find that. And what Leopold reports is that the FBI has accidentally or inadvertently disclosed that they blackball. They have a formal policy called blackballing of certain types of FOIA requests. And this came to light in some research that was done by an author named Griffey, who is a teacher at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. His name is Trevor Griffey. And he did some research on the file of Malcolm X, and he wanted to see if a previous request by a writer and researcher named Manning Marable showed up in the FBI files. And what a low-level agency operative, or just somebody who signed a letter to him, revealed was that, oh, well, you know, some of that information has been blackballed. And so, as I mentioned earlier, if you don't use the right keywords, they can decline your request, just saying, oh, well, you didn't use the right term, so we don't have to cough up the information. And Griffey received 5 pages from an untitled, undated PowerPoint presentation that outlines the procedures for blackballing files from FOIA requests. And some of it is a little sensible. You know, they don't have to respond and serve up personnel or medical files that would constitute a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. But what really surfaces here is that the agency doesn't honor either the spirit, the letter, or the intent of the FOIA law. And, for example, one of the items cited here in the Truth Out report is that a guy makes a request for his, quote, FBI file in 2005, and we process it for him. When he makes another request for his same FBI file in 2011, we will only process his records, but will not process the file that was created to respond to that request back in 2005. And this enables them to skirt the law and to hide information that, under the law, they are required to release. And so here's a quote from a fellow named McClanahan, who is quoted in this article, Kel McClanahan, who is executive director of the National Security Counselors, a public interest law firm. And he said, well, even though the FBI may blackball 50 records and release 3, they never tell the requester about the 50. They never mention word 1 about, and we found other records that we deemed non-responsive. The requester is left to wonder why the FBI only found 3 records about the subject in question, and he'll never know that they found 50 others. So, in some ways, this is not that surprising, but it's just another outrage where our government is big brothering our legal rights and the clear laws that are on the books. And, of course, they claim that they're keeping us all safe and, therefore, they can do these things. And, well, frankly, I think it's just more of the creeping police state that we see here in the United States. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number. I know they take away your name. Chris Hedges is a great American. He has appeared on this program and joined me for interviews on various venues where I have been heard over the past few years. He is a former divinity student. He spent years in the Middle East as the bureau chief for the New York Times. He is an outspoken supporter of the Occupy movement and has challenged President Obama almost from day one on many of the shortcomings that are very clear by now of the Obama presidency. And on January 16th, he announced that attorneys Carl Mayer and Bruce Afran have filed a complaint on his behalf, suing President Obama and Secretary of Defense Panetta to challenge the legality of the authorization for use of military force that is in the latest version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which Obama signed in Hawaii on December 31st. And you've heard me talk about the evils of this NDAA. And I am grateful that Chris Hedges is putting himself on the line and suing the government to challenge what I believe is a clear unconstitutional measure. And Carl Mayer, one of the attorneys, has represented me in a class action suit regarding the illegal wiretapping that started under Bush and continues to this day. And Carl Mayer and hopefully Chris Hedges will join me for an interview later this week, and we'll have excerpts here on the News and Comment podcast and the full-length interview available at peterbcollins.com. Now, one of the reasons Hedges is so well-suited to file this suit is disclosed in his article, which you can read at truthdig.com. He says, "I met regularly with leaders of Hamas, Islamic Jihad in Gaza. I used to visit Palestine Liberation Organization leaders, including Arafat and Abu Jihad in Tunis. I have spent time with the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. I was in northern Iraq and southeastern Turkey with the fighters of the KPP, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. All these entities were or are labeled as terrorist organizations by the U.S. government. What would this bill have meant if it had been in place when I and other Americans traveled in the 80s with armed units of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua or the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front guerrillas in El Salvador?" Hedges goes on, "Once a group is deemed to be a terrorist organization, whether it is a Palestinian charity or an element of the Uyghur independence movement, the military can, under this bill, pick up a U.S. citizen who supported charities associated with the group or unwittingly sent money or medical supplies to front groups." It's really chilling. And he continues, "On the whim of the military, a suspected terrorist who also happens to be a U.S. citizen can suffer extraordinary rendition, being kidnapped and then left to rot in one of our black sites until the end of hostilities, which could be a very long stay." Chris Hedges continues, and this is a very powerful part. Listen carefully. "The supine and gutless Democratic Party, which would have feigned outrage if George W. Bush had put this into law, appears willing once again to grant Obama a pass. But I won't," says Hedges. "What he has done is unforgivable, unconstitutional, and exceedingly dangerous. The threat and reach of Al-Qaeda, which I spent a year covering for the New York Times in Europe and the Middle East, are marginal despite the attacks of 9/11. The terrorist group poses no existential threat to the nation. It has been so disrupted and broken that it can barely function. Osama bin Laden was gunned down by commandos, his body dumped into the sea. Even the Pentagon says the organization is crippled. So why, a decade after the start of the so-called war on terror, do these draconian measures need to be implemented? Why do citizens now need to be specifically singled out for military detention and denial of due process when under the 2001 authorization for use of military force, the president can apparently find the legal cover to serve as judge, jury, and executioner to assassinate U.S. citizens, as he did in the killing of cleric Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen? Why is this bill necessary when the government routinely ignores our Fifth Amendment rights, which say, quote, no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law, as well as our First Amendment right of free speech?" And he closes his comment with this. "I suspect it passed because the corporations, seeing the unrest in the streets, knowing that things are about to get much worse, worrying that the Occupy movement will expand, do not trust the police to protect them. They want to be able to call in the army, and now they can." Well, as I said, we are trying to line up a conversation time with Chris Hedges and his attorney, Carl Mayer. So stay tuned here at peterbcollins.com, and we will bring that to you in the next few days or a week. Over this past long holiday weekend, there was a lot of coverage of the Costa Concordia. This is the cruise ship with more than 4,000 passengers that ran aground and then tipped over off the coast of Italy. And it's a horror on many levels. I'm a sailor, and I have only been on a cruise ship once, and it was a Costa cruise ship in the Caribbean. And we didn't have any incidents like this, but I have to say that I knew that the waiters and other staff members who were there to provide hospitality were not trained even to the level of flight attendants to deal with a problem if the ship ran aground or, sprung a leak. They're trained to say, "Can I get you another drink?" Not, "Here's how to get to a lifeboat and how to save your ass." And so hopefully many lessons will be learned from this, and at least cruise ships that Americans go on and that come into American ports will have higher standards of safety training. The captain here is a blight on sailors and ship's captains of the centuries. He left his ship while people were still on it, and when authorities in town tried to send him back to the ship, he begged not to return. And one report is that the captain was having drinks with a hot babe in one of the bars when the boat hit a rock, and we've seen that rock now embedded in the hull of this ship. And it's stunning in many ways that these monster ships have been permitted to be created. Because if you know anything, and here I want to defer to my boat-building buddy Mark in Australia, but listen to this. The Costa Concordia is 177 feet tall, but it only draws 26 feet underwater. And this is bigger than a Nimitz-class U.S. aircraft carrier, or about the same size, according to an article I have in front of me. And the British writer who wrote this says, "Obviously, the Costa fleet has less firepower than the USS Nimitz, except in the drinks department. U.S. warships are dry." But just think about this. The boat draws 26 feet underwater, but is nearly 200 feet tall. And when it ran aground, I'm still trying to figure out why it keeled over. It appears that the water level dropped either because of tides or because the boat was it shifted closer to shore. But I have a sailboat that has a relatively deep keel. And if I get into shallow water and then the tide goes down, the boat will be stranded on the keel and it could, knock itself over or go a breach, as we would say, the way this cruise ship did. But it's still amazing to me that there wasn't some sort of stabilization designed into this relatively recently built craft. And, I'm sure that much more will be written about this. But I want to thank one of my loyal listeners, Jeff Zeiser in Portland, Oregon, who forwarded me an article from The Guardian, the newspaper in the UK. And this piece, let's see who it's written by here. Okay, it doesn't jump right out at me who the author is. But it's very clever because it moves from a description of these events and compares it to the banking crisis worldwide. And he says, "You might say that the banks and the boat each suffered from an acute liquidity crisis. Suddenly, there wasn't enough cash or water to keep them upright. And many captains abandoned their ship and left the customers holding the bag." Boy, this is quite a mixed metaphor, but you could see where it's going. And Jeff properly pointed out that in this article, there's one big boneheaded error. Here, see if you can pick it out. "In Europe and the U.S., the economic ship has been taking on water since reckless seamanship drove it on the rocks/iceberg in the crisis of 07-08. The banking captains were mostly fired, some jailed in the U.S., not in Europe, and the salvage teams are making a poor job of floating us all off." Well, my British friend, whose name I don't know, check your records. we haven't seen anybody go to jail in this country. Not for financial fraud, only Bernie Madoff. And he wasn't part of the Wall Street meltdown. That was a completely separate Ponzi scheme and investigation. In the state of Wisconsin, they've submitted more than 1 million signatures to recall Republican Governor Scott Walker. And this is going to be a very interesting process over the next few months. Only two sitting governors have been removed in this manner in the last century in this country, and one of them was right here in California when Arnold Schwarzenegger took the place of Gray Davis, who was recalled just because it was possible. He hadn't been drunk on the job. He didn't get involved in any deep scandal. He was bought and paid for by corporate interests, but so far that's not a crime, at least not in California. So I really commend the people of the Badger State, and I hope they will remain vigilant because we have seen their elections stolen, manipulated in the past few years, and that includes the recall elections last year and the state Supreme Court justice race last year. So I hope that people will be vigilant and that this effort will pay off and result in the removal of Scott Walker from the governorship in Wisconsin. And finally today, the South Carolina primary, where the mudslingers go to duke it out and candidates go to see if they can survive the onslaught. And it's really muddy. Really muddy. It's very interesting to see. There was a debate, let's see, on Fox News, co-sponsored with the Wall Street Journal. And it was actually a pretty lively exchange. Juan Williams, who got fired from PBS and NPR, provided a lot of the firepower. And the weird thing about this Fox News debate was they didn't have ground rules asking the members of the audience not to applaud or boo. And so it was like a World Wrestling Federation event where the Fox News anchors, with the exception of Williams, would fire up these pandering questions, and then people would cheer and boo, depending on how they liked the responses and whether they were conservative, arch-conservative, or Neanderthal. And it was interesting on a number of levels. The backdrop to this is that over the past week, there have been a lot of discussions on the New York Times blog because the public editor raised the question about whether news reporters, not columnists, but news reporters, can properly challenge a lie when it's delivered by a presidential candidate. And the new executive editor, Jill Abramson, was offended and embarrassed by this and said, well, of course it's okay. We simply haven't seen any of that in the news columns of the New York Times this year. And the truthiness problem is really, you know, embedded in most of the Republican candidates. But Mitt Romney appears to be the leader, the worst. And he repeatedly uses innuendo, for example, to say that President Obama has apologized to the world for American behavior. And fact checkers have tried to run that down. There is no example ever cited by Mitt Romney when he makes that broad-based allegation. And they can find no exact quote that would even come close to supporting the contention that Romney makes. And likewise, Newt Gingrich likes to smear Obama as the champion food stamp president. And he flies right by the reason that 50 million people in this country are using food stamps today. It's because of the wreckage to the economy caused by Republicans and the very policies that these boneheads are running on today. Romney, Gingrich, Santorum, and Ron Paul, they all embrace the same failed economic policies, the supply-side trickle-down approach that have created the mess that we're in. And, of course, that's never brought up by news anchors or those who question the candidates at these debates. And I never thought I'd say something nice about Rick Santorum, but he took our side. in a question that came up about the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, first of all, I was shocked that the Fox News Channel would bring up an issue where these candidates actually ended up praising President Obama for killing Osama bin Laden, for example. But the question was raised, and Rick Santorum, along with Ron Paul, took clear positions saying that they didn't support the expansion of power and the issues that Chris Hedges is suing over in the NDAA. Shocking. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to flip and support Rick Santorum. But when one of these nut jobs takes the proper position, I think it's worth pointing out. The real low point of the debate, which produced the greatest applause, in fact, a standing ovation for Newt Gingrich, was when he argued with Juan Williams about the food stamp issue and about Gingrich's call to employ high school students as junior janitors. And Juan Williams properly pointed out that this is a pretty offensive proposal. I mean, it's child labor, and it's a real condescending approach. But Gingrich is unfazed by reality and by sentiment and just plowed ahead and said, oh, no, I'm right about this, and proceeded to tell us an anecdote about some niece of his who got a job cleaning a school at the age of 13, and it changed her life for the better. The condescension of these candidates, these wealthy Republicans, when they talk about, for example, people who have exhausted their unemployment benefits after 99 weeks. And despite, again, the wrecked economy that has no jobs, that has four job seekers for every decent job opening that's out there, they just ignore that reality and talk about the Republican philosophy, which is that work is so cherished and so valuable that we should cut people off unemployment benefits, and they were picking numbers between 36 and 49 weeks. Who the hell are they to interfere with an insurance-based program? And I'll acknowledge that if you've been on unemployment 99 weeks, you have probably spent more than you put into your unemployment account. But the fundamental is unemployment is not welfare. It's not a bailout. It's an insurance program that every employee paid into while they were working. And these fat cat mofos stand up on the stage and basically say that if you've been unemployed for longer than a year, that you're lazy, that you don't have a work ethic, and we ought to retrain you to be a dishwasher. And it is just so insulting to see this unchallenged by the other fat cats, the rich hairdos of the media, who sit there and preside over these events. So it is wild in many ways to watch all this going on. And we will see if South Carolina does become the end of the line for another candidate. John Huntsman has bailed out, not wanting to face the meat grinder in South Carolina. And in closing, I want to cite an article that just went up today on Salon.com, written by my friend Richard Rappaport. And it's a history of South Carolina primary politics, including the role of the Ku Klux Klan right up until just a few decades ago. And he closes his piece with this. The blood sport that is politics in South Carolina has produced some of the most heinous campaigns in recent American history. There was, for instance, the Vicious Whisper campaign about a colored child that George W. Bush's campaign employed in 2000 to torpedo the candidacy of John McCain. There was the innuendo in 2008 about various adulteries allegedly carried on by current Governor Nikki Haley. And then there is the current spate of slasher political ads being broadcast by the Gingrich, Perry, and Romney campaigns in South Carolina today. Their gleeful use helps second, with a slight revision, James Pettigrew's epithet, South Carolina, too small to be a republic, right size to be an asylum. And this just reminded me that one of the bizarre moments of the debate on Monday night was when Mitt Romney was confronted about what his super PAC has been dishing out in negative TV ads. And he was crying crocodile tears that would make John Boehner embarrassed and saying, oh, you know, if we could just get rid of McCain-Feingold and raise as much money into the campaign itself, we could shut down these independent expenditures, these super PACs. And that is such bullshit. And, of course, it dances right around the Citizens United decision by the right-wing-packed Supreme Court voting 5-4 that said corporations are people and they have free speech rights in political campaigns. You can't touch that if you're a Republican candidate. So even though they publicly say they want their super PACs to stop the slime, they don't mean it. And the idea that you can use Citizens United as an excuse to blow off what is left of our campaign finance laws just shows how far out of touch these people really are. Thanks for listening. Drop by my website, peterbcollins.com, and send me your comments, full of it, at peterbcollins.com. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.